Hello, and welcome to Harp Column Podcast, taking you behind the stories in Harp Column from a practical harpist's perspective. My name is Christina Finch, and I will be your guide to all things harp. Today's episode is brought to you by Harp Column Music at harpcolummusic.com, where you can download PDFs of some of the best new arrangements and compositions for solo, ensemble, and chamber harp. Harp Column Music feature composer Sharon Stevenson's focus is on healing through her harp music, paintings, and poems. Her Healing Harmony collection is made up of a multitude of unique and lovely pieces that are playable on both lever and pedal harp. The Essence of Joy collection contains five of Sharon's most popular compositions. Each of the pieces included in the album is inspired by an original poem and painting by the composer, and is available at www.harpcolummusic.com for only $20. For episode 16, we welcome back harpist and teacher Anne Sullivan, author of the article titled Gold Star Student in the current issue of Harp Column. Currently the harp instructor at the University of Delaware, Anne runs harpmastery.com, an online resource and learning center for harpists of all ages and skill levels. If you haven't had a chance to read Anne's article about being a Gold Star student, I encourage you to head over to www.harpcolumn.com and give it a read. Whether you're still in school, are teaching students of your own, or are working at the harp without professional guidance, Anne has some really interesting and insightful advice about practicing, being forgiving of yourself, and pursuing your dreams.
Get right into it. Okay.
Yeah, I loved your article. I thought it was, very well timed with this, you know, beginning of the school year and everything. And I'm really excited to talk to you because I love that you were so honest in your article about yourself as a student. I was very similar as an undergraduate. Miss Bride would tell you up, down, backwards and forwards that I was a very challenging student.
I was pretty terrible. I mean, I was the kind of terrible student that was good enough that I could do really well most of the time. But truthfully, one of the reasons I share about how terrible a student I was is because so many of the people that I teach, not so much young people, but people who started the harp as an adult, even if they start in their 20s, you know, they're thinking that they're behind the eight ball, that everybody learned and did better and everybody is better than they are and that there is some magic process that they missed. And the truth is that it's not really until our late teens or our 20s that we really, for most of us anyway, figure out how to learn and how to do this on our own. And it's not being a star student at age 12 that's going to indicate how your future success path goes.
My mother used to threaten me with selling my harp.
Oh, yeah. Every week my parents would do that. Well, they started by trying to sell the piano. And then once I took up the harp, they were selling both instruments. So I was an equally bad practicer on both. What's interesting to me, really, is that I never took them as totally empty threats, even though I'm sure deep down I knew they weren't going to sell them. What it was for me was really a pretty serious nudge as to how important this was to me and that they couldn't sell it because I had to have it and had to do it. It's just that I really hated doing the practice.
So can you think of a moment in your early life as a harpist where your lack of preparation or lack of ability to practice really burned you in a performance setting?
Well, there were probably plenty of them. I get a reminder every year. I'd been playing with a community orchestra. I was 14, 15, and the orchestra had asked me to play some solos on a Christmas concert. It was a big deal, and the whole orchestra was sitting on stage, and I was right on the edge, and I had to play 6 or 7 minutes. And my teacher and I agreed, at least I hope I remember to ask her. Maybe I did. That's not earning a gold star as a student, by the way, not to tell your teacher what you're playing. I decided to play the 5 Salzedo paraphrases on Christmas carols. They're all 2 pages long. They're not easy. They're not overly challenging, but, you know, they were totally doable. I had committed to playing those. It was in the program, and I must have started practicing them that week. I don't really know, but I know that I was in a cramped practice situation, which was not unusual for me. And I was old enough at this point to realize I was going to have to figure out how to get through this. So I thought, well, I'm committed to this. I can't change the repertoire. I can't back out of the concert. I just have to figure out how to do it. My natural tendency is just to take the happy, speedy tempos that I hear in my head. And that wasn't going to work, not for this, because those carols were just a little too tricky with all the stuff in the high register and the big chords. And I could do it, but not if I just abandoned myself to the Christmas carol. So in my book, at the top of every Christmas carol, I changed every title of every Christmas carol to include the word slow. It came upon the midnight slow. Slow sleeves, angels we have heard on slow, which makes no sense, but there it was. We slow kings of Orient are, and oh, slow town of Bethlehem. I still have this copy and I still play from it. And so every year when I get those out and I play them, it's just one of those little humbling reminders that, oh yeah, okay, I'm never going there again. I'm never cramming quite that way again. Now, I will tell you, I didn't learn the lesson quite that solidly the first time around because there were other instances where I was having to do the same kind of triage. But it got me through that concert and I never erased those words so that every time I pull out the carols, there they are.
I think a lot of us have felt that panic feeling of being underprepared. I know I have. Many times. It took a long time for me to realize that preparation is not only essential, but it's just for your own peace of mind in a concert setting.
But preparation requires thinking ahead of time. You know, you can't just decide to prepare the way I was in that instance, the week before. It requires an actual timeline and sort of thinking things out. And that's one of the things that I love to do with my students, really back think, you know, and say, okay, well, if this is the recital, then here's your preview, then here's your other test performances, and then you have to have this piece done by then, this piece done by then, this at this stage, this at this stage. So all of a sudden, that, you know, senior recital or whatever it is, we've planned out the entire semester or the entire school year to begin to understand that that's the way preparation really starts, was for me just a life-changing event, because I certainly didn't learn that until I'd been playing the harp for a very long time. I don't think that students can really take full responsibility for their own learning until later in high school and into college. But right around the age of 13, 14, 15, I start trying to train my students on purpose and with their knowledge to take over more and more of not just the responsibility for their practicing, but the creation of their daily practice routine. So if this is what you want to accomplish by the end of the week, what are you going to do that? How are you going to do, if you want it to be hands together by Friday, what are you going to have to do on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday in order to make that work? Having them start to think about that instead of just following directions that I write down in a notebook, or instead of, you know, the all-time worst thing that we teachers do, and we all do it from time to time at least, to say, okay, well, so you'll do that by next week. And then we just go on to the next thing, and we've given no direction at all about how a student is supposed to accomplish that. I have chosen to think of my lack of motivation as really the fact that, and this is going to sound sort of silly, but I don't think I understood what you were supposed to be doing in your practice. As I said, this is going to sound kind of stupid. Practice makes things better. As long as you know what the point of it is, and that the point is not repetition. Lots of times you'll have to do something over and over again in order to achieve a particular goal. And for me, it was that I never understood exactly what that daily practice goal was supposed to do, how it was supposed to fit into the larger goal, which for me was just, you know, okay, yeah, I'm going to learn the piece. The reward of practice is not in the task itself, but it's knowing that the task that you're doing is so focused and so properly directed that it's going to lead you to that goal that you're looking for.
Thank you. Do you require your students to keep a lesson book? Do you write in it at all? Or do you require that your students take notes?
I'm very flexible on this. We usually do have some kind of a lesson book, and it's a lesson book of some kind that the student likes. I mean, they're responsible for getting it. Some people will have loose leaf notebooks. Some people will have scratch pads. Some people will have journals with pretty bindings, you know, that they really like in their favorite colors. All that's good. I almost always will add some kind of note in there so that if it's something that we're discovering as we go through the lesson and we don't want to forget it, I'll jot it down. It's really individual as to what the student wants to keep track of. But for me, it's a tool for the student's personal accountability. And if they choose not to do that, that's okay. But I can't think of a high school student that I have walked out of a lesson without knowing that they had something written down. And you can even do a two-column approach or a two-page approach where your notes are on the left-hand page, and then you and the student take 5 minutes to translate those notes into instructions. And think how cool that would be, because they've got your notes, they've got their instructions, and then 6 years later when they're in college and their teacher isn't telling them anymore what to do, they can go back and they can say, okay, this was what my teacher wanted me to do, and this was how she told me to do it. So I can take that to any other lesson. You know, you've showed them how to solve a practice problem. This is the problem. These are the notes. This is how we did it. The other thing is that, to go back to what we were talking about before, if you don't tell them and show them exactly what their practice week is supposed to look like, how will they know? It's not taking time from the lesson to write it down. That's part of the lesson. You're instructing them on how to practice. You know how to do it. I know how to do it. But the student doesn't know how to do it or be done.
You're listening to Harp Column Podcast, episode number 16. You can read more harp news, feature stories, and subscribe to the print magazine at www.harpcolumn.com. In the coming months, Harp Column Podcast will be releasing mini episodes featuring interviews with college students about their experiences at given schools and with given teachers. Through the process of recording these episodes, I've had the opportunity to speak with some really sharp young harpists. And in every interview, I end with the same question: if all of your harp dreams come true, where will you be in 10 years? And the answers have been really interesting. The idea of dreams is something that Anne mentioned in her article when discussing her acronym, LEARN. I want to discuss dreams and the cultivation of dreams in students with Anne.
I do like to encourage my students to dream, and I do find that a lot of students are reluctant to do that because they want to know what the next thing is. And you can't blame them. I mean, we all want to know what comes next. We don't want to imagine something vast and amorphous and with all these kinds of feelings tied into it, because we're afraid that it's either going to be too big or too small. A dream is a goal that doesn't have a name yet, because when you have a goal, it's a focus, it's concrete, it has an end. We sort of talk about that in terms of coming to the end of working on this recital program or coming to this exam period. So what are we going to do next? If you could play any kind of piece of music, what would you want to do? Search around YouTube, listen to some things, find who's doing something that's interesting that you think you would like to try. What do you think you need to do to get there? What kind of skills would you have that you don't have that we'd have to develop? And let's take you closer. And even if it's some outrageous sort of dream that doesn't seem to fit with a standard university music curriculum, we can find things that they're going to need to get to that dream that we can work on. Whatever it is, there are going to be ways to plug into that, sort of bridge that gap and make the dream seem a little bit more possible. I can take a student through a curriculum, but if that curriculum doesn't mean anything to them when they get out, if it doesn't connect them to their life, for some of the students I teach who aren't music majors but are just sort of continuing their harp studies, my big thing is in their senior year, it's okay, this is probably the last year that you're going to be able to take harp lessons and practice and play the harp the way you want, because as soon as you get out of school, you're going to go into medical school, or you're going to be looking for your engineering job, or you're going to whatever it is. So our focus is going to be twofold. One, exploring some of the areas that you think you might like to explore with the harp someday. And more importantly, teaching you how to come back to the harp, because you're going to put it away for 4 years, 6 years, 10 years, maybe before you get back to it. So what are you going to need to come back to? Because this is your plan. When you've been away for a while, you're going to say, okay, I'm ready to start harp now. So I'm going to look at this and this and this and this, and I'm going to pull back, and this is where I'm going to start. When you think that a lot of these young people have invested 12 years or more into their harp playing, and then they're not going to play for a while because real life, their other life is going to take over. And so many of them are really, really accomplished players, and they love it. And it was a hard choice for them to decide on medical school instead of the conservatory. And so to make that choice and to make them feel good about it, they need to know that they're not giving up the harp. They're putting it aside, and they'll be back. And this is how it's going to happen for them. This is how they can come back.
That's it for our 16th episode. Many thanks to our guest, Anne Sullivan. Music for today's episode comes from The Art of Imagination, a new CD by the Queens Duo, with harpist Hannah Rabe and flutist Verena Beatrix Schulte, reviewed in the current issue of Harp Column by Allison Young. To learn more about Harp Column, please visit www.harpcolumn.com and subscribe today to gain access to current and past issues, as well as a lot of great web content. My name is Dr. Christina Finch, and we at Harp Column hope that you have a spectacular week. Thank you.